today's Nobel Peace Talk, we will discuss how technology is used as a weapon against human rights activists and ordinary people by such regimes as the one in Iran. Surveillance cameras and face recognition is used to target women who are not wearing a hijab correctly. Organized smear campaigns are used as an effort to silence those who speak up against the regime. And there are many more examples. And to give us more examples and to talk more about how this is widely used and more so, we have a very small but very competent panel. So I want you to welcome Mahsa Alimardani. She has been working on digital rights in the Middle East and North Africa within civil society since 2012 and is an expert on Iran's internet situation. She leads Article 19's work on digital rights in the region with a specialization on information controls in... You can sit over here.
Thank you.
She'll be joined by Gerald Folkvord, political advisor at Amnesty International's office here in Oslo. He's been working with Amnesty for more than 30 years and is an expert in digital technology, military and policing and human rights in Iran. And I want to add that this event tonight is co-organized with Amnesty International Norway. Welcome, Gerald Folkvord. And to lead the discussion, we're lucky to have Samina Ansari. She's a lawyer and leader of the Avjanna Initiative with a background in cybersecurity law and diplomacy. I will leave the floor and the conversation in your cunning hands. Samina, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you all for joining us on this sunny evening in Oslo. We will speak about how regimes and states and governments are using technology to limit rights and liberties of individuals, not only in Iran, but beyond. But before we start this conversation, we all know that this is an interesting time in the Middle East. And I'm very curious to hear from both of you how you're feeling about the role of Iran right now. And Mahsa, would you like to start?
I mean, it's been quite intense, I guess, few days of uncertainty in terms of what's going to be happening in the region. And it's particularly harrowing when you have family and loved ones, I guess, in the region and you're constantly thinking about them. But of course, you know, in these geopolitical games between states, it's always ordinary people that are really at the front lines of harm. And that's really what we've been seeing in Iran. We've been focusing on this geopolitical game between Iran and Israel. Meanwhile, the repression and pressure on ordinary Iranians has been increasing, whether it's the recent crackdown on hijab enforcement, which has been horrific in the past few days. And it started on the very first day of the threat of war when Iran's was about to start its attack on Israel. And then it doubled with this pressure and crackdown on different activists and different voices online in terms of how they were framing the debate between Iran and Israel. And we've saw some warnings and threats going out to activists who are, you know, talking maybe even sympathetically or even neutrally, but not perhaps in favor of Iran's attack. And so the repression has really increased. Meanwhile, the world is paying attention to this geopolitical game.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing. Gerald, would you like to comment?
Yeah. Crisis, international tensions always are positive for authoritarian regimes because it distracts from their crimes. And it's not by chance that this is happening. After the world had almost has become more and more unified in looking at the horrible crimes that Israel is committing in Gaza every day, there comes this almost unthinkable attack on a consulate in another country, something which is kind of the violation of the most basic rules of international cooperation. And then there comes the Iranian counterattack, which was just as easily to foresee. And now we talk about international diplomacy, we talk about politics, and we do not talk, as I say, about people on the ground.
Right.
not only the people dying in Palestine, but also the people who are being severely oppressed in Iran, and the people suffering in many other countries in the region, whose leaders also are part of these diplomatic games and now trying to stake out positive positions. And, you know, when it comes to making deals, one of the first things is always, if you want us to be part of a deal, you have to go easy about our human rights violations. And I'm afraid this is what we are going to see. We're going to see human rights of ordinary people again be marginalized by the international political deal makers.
This is incredibly challenging. And Gerald, to just continue with you, considering the pivotal role that internet and technology played and demonstrations and protests in Iran and asset for mobilization, but also a tool of oppression?
Yes, certainly. I would actually like to look a bit further back to the year 2009, where there were massive protests after presidential elections in Iran, which many people claimed had been rigged. And the regime there reacted as they always did. They shut down media outlets. They put every international journalist under house arrest. They tried to contain the spreading of information. But what they didn't expect was people in the streets using their smartphones to film the police killing people in the streets and putting it on YouTube. Right. And this was a wake-up call for the Iranian regime. This is something new we have to deal with. And we have, Ingvild said at the beginning, I've been with Amnesty for a long time. I started working at Amnesty when we didn't even have the internet. That's how old I am. And then we saw this emerging of this fantastic new tool, which meant that ordinary people could inform each other about what was going on. They didn't have to care about government censorship of traditional media and all that. But of course, in the meantime, we have seen that governments and especially authoritarian regimes are trying to hijack this new technology, turning it around and using it to their own advantage.
Right. And Mahsa, you work for Article 19 and your organization contributed to the UN fact-finding mission, highlighted crimes and abuses committed in digital spaces. Could you provide some specific example of these abuses and their implication on human rights and women's rights?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to talk about the fact-finding mission as well and the incredible momentum that went into establishing it. And it was the work of organizations like Amnesty, organization I work for, and a massive cadre of civil society organizations that really pushed for this and made it happen. And it was an extraordinary kind of consensus that we saw globally because of the momentum of woman life freedom, where we had states even in the global south that aren't normally aligned and pushing for pressure against Iran's human rights abuses that voted for this fact-finding mission. So it's really incredible the kind of, I guess, global solidarity that we saw that went into this. And of course, what we were following really were the abuses that were taking place in the digital sphere that were contributing to what the report eventually concluded were crimes against humanity. And so back all the way to 2019, we really established the fact that internet shutdowns in the way that the Islamic Republic uses them are really facilitating these very horrific crimes. In 2019, famously, they shut down the internet for over a week. And in the blackout that this enabled, they were able to massacre what is estimated to be over 1,500 protesters. And of course, what this impact had, and this was a really great work done by the Amnesty Tech team and us at Article 19, really looking at the impact of this shutdown in terms of these different crimes that were occurring in different cities in November 2019. And what we really saw that internet shutdowns were enabling these crimes, and the power that this had has really continued in different ways and different policies the regime has had, and they kind of enabled it in more sophisticated ways again in 2022. And so this is what we were trying to really document, as well as the ways in which surveillance was being used against the state. And having tracked internet policy in Iran for a while and trying to understand how this has an impact on these kind of real world crimes. For example, you've had the nationalization of the Iranian internet, and that might sound kind of broad and, talk of infrastructure, but we saw real world cases where we've had national applications. So you have Uber and Uber Food, and we have the national versions of these. And it seems they're like benign apps. It's called Snap Food. And they were sharing data with the state basically about their users to track down different activists. We've had at least two different cases of activists who were kind of pinpointed to have participated in protests in October and November of 2022. And the regime worked with these companies to geolocate them and go and arrest them. And so these kind of small, these benign types of technology and the ways that they're working with the state, obviously the sophisticated ways in which they're enacting censorship, these are all the different ways that we've seen how the digital space is really getting weaponized.
Right. And I read some reports from Amnesty International when it also comes to how the regime uses a specific app. In addition to that, they also use surveillance technology to actually track down female drivers and also women in cars that don't have that have inappropriate hijabs. Would you like to say something about that?
What the point Maza was making is very important that digital tools are right now in Iran something that is combined with ordinary harassment and persecution. You described the tracking of mobile phones used as evidence, in quotation marks, against people who they wanted to put in prison. We also have many, many examples where they were tracking people's mobile phones. They can do that. More or less tracking every mobile phone they want. They can also shut it down if they want. They can slow it down if they want to. But they were also sending text messages to people, telling them, I know that you are in the vicinity of a demonstration. And if you don't get away quickly, we will take you. And this is happening to thousands and thousands of people. And that's also very important. It's not, when we think of Iran, we think about heroes like Narges Mohammadi. And these heroes are very, very central because they keep the belief in human rights going in the population. But they are people who know what they are doing. But there are thousands and thousands of people who suddenly get a text message. We know we are watching you. And of course, they go away. And this kind of what in technical language is called a chilling effect, the government trying to make people not dare do anything because you never know what's happening, what might happen to me and to my family. That is probably one of the major objectives of this oppressive campaign. Not primarily tracking down the real critics, but primarily scaring the vast majority of people from participating in any way or doing anything that might even remotely look like criticism of the government. And then you have this other element you're talking about, which goes parallel, the absurd oppression of women by law in Iran, which has been there for a long time, obviously for decades, but which has increased after the Women Life Freedom protests in 2022, has been increased by law. There are now stricter laws. There are harsher punishments for women who violate some stupid rule in some way. Has been increased by instructions to the police. We now want you to go out in the streets and get these women and punish them. When I talk to colleagues also from other countries in the Middle East, they still say, but Iran, is actually a country where women can move quite freely because the police doesn't really care about all these laws. But that has changed, because the police now is instructed to care about these laws. And then there comes the digital technology. Again, technology they have had in place for many years, mostly gotten from China, then also from Russia as kind of reward for Iran supplying arms to the Ukraine war. And
I see, because that was also my other question about where Iran is getting its technology from.
But I'm getting. We can get back to that. But what they have done now is roll out their quite well-established system with facial recognition, trying to identify women who, while driving a car or while sitting in a car. We have cases where 9-year-old children were tracked down by facial recognition cameras because they didn't have their hijab correctly. And then again, react, send a message, say you are going to be severely punished if they do this ever again, or taking away their cars, confiscating the cars for a time. And mostly it's the family car. So confiscating the car of the family might have very severe consequences for the family's economy and the possibility of movement and all these things. And again, it's this kind of bullying put in action that has affected hundreds of thousands of women, as far as we know. And in combination with stricter laws, with whipping as a punishment for women who violate the rules, with very easily, always there is always the danger around the corner that if somebody doesn't like you, they can put you to revolutionary court and accuse you of enmity against God, and then there is no limit to what they can do to you.
Yeah, because technology is only one tool.
Yeah, exactly.
They
yeah.
still have all the old yeah. methods. And it's incredibly difficult to also work in these topics. And Masa, I know that you yourself in Article 19 have also been accused for, falsely accused for deleting social media accounts of human rights activists and women's rights activists that are opposing the regime. So I would like to invite you to share about your experiences working in this topic as well.
Yeah, so I guess working with social media companies to ensure that they're upholding human rights and protecting human rights defenders is one of the aspects of the work that we're doing. I mean, in October of 2022, we were talking about the chilling effects. One of the greatest chilling effects that the regime had against the protest movement was arresting over 20,000 protesters within the span of a couple of months. And so as they were doing this, this was an extremely young generation of protesters. It was, you know, a predominantly Gen Z driven movement we saw in Iran. And so this is a generation that's extremely online. Everyone has social media accounts, where, you know, a lot of expression, a lot of private conversations. And as you can imagine, Gen Z in Iran, private conversations are probably not following, you know, the strictures and moral code of the Islamic Republic. I mean, almost everyone I talk to, their social life, there's probably something that's going against the, you know, Islamic penal code in terms of the morality they're going against. And so when these arrests were happening, there was really a need for companies to rally and start protecting, taking away the digital evidence there was. And, you know, Iran's really horrific and oftentimes arbitrary judicial system to take away those extra criminalizations. I mean, at one point, Sharif University, there was a crackdown where authorities suddenly went into the residences of Sharif University and were arresting mass amounts of students. And I remember the friend of one student, a queer student whose, you know, whole sexual identity is criminalized by the state. They were worried that the content in the DMs of their Twitter was going to be used against them. And so we had to do everything we could to get in touch with the companies to make sure that these accounts, that account would get secure. And it was, you know, this moment of real tension of like, we have hours before the authorities take over this young queer student's account and, you know, further add charges onto his or their already, you know, existing protest charges. And so this need to work with companies was really urgent, especially in the first few months when we had these mass arrests. And so this was really the kind of work we were doing and trying to establish. And I guess I think you're referring to the statement where there was a series of suspensions of Twitter accounts, I think belonging to a faction of the opposition known as the monarchists. And we were falsely accused of being behind this. And I couldn't even start to understand why we were, and I think it was just because we were doing this work of trying right. to work with the companies, and so this kind of got wrapped up into this. And in fact, we had received some calls for help where, you know, these accounts have been falsely suspended, can you help or restore them? So it was a very confusing time of why suddenly this campaign got turned around on us, who we were right. trying to help, and we were putting all this time to help. But I guess this is the kind of space we often work in human rights, where you do have so many different types of campaigns trying to divert attention and trying to, whether it is, you know, with good intentions or bad intentions, this misinformation comes about. I mean, at certain points in the Women, Life, Freedom movement, we've saw concerted campaigns that were clearly, at the end of it, you could clearly see the regime was behind it. So there was this really one great example, and this is the only one I think that we can truly attribute to the Islamic Republic, which was we had protests outside of a prison. So we had three protesters who were arrested for their participation in the Women, Life, Freedom protests, and their executions were imminent. I believe this was Mohammed Sayed, I forget his name, and Mehdi Karami. And this was, I believe, in January of 2023. There were mass protests every night outside of the prison to make sure these executions were stopped. And this became a movement. And for a while, it did seem like they were preventing the executions because the streets were being blocked. And then all of a sudden, we had this Twitter account that had over 100,000 followers. And this Twitter account had been able to gain a lot of legitimacy amongst opposition because they had presented themselves with this identity of being this opposition account. And suddenly this account in the middle of this movement to stop the executions came out with this groundbreaking news. It became headlines on CNN that this judge, this very famous judge, Abulqasem Salavati, known as the hanging judge because he's often behind the execution orders of political prisoners, that he had been assassinated in Tehran. This became headline news, and people kind of diverted their attention from the stop execution campaign. And then people started looking into this, despite the fact this had made global headlines. People stopped paying attention to this. There was less people outside of the prisons. And as people started questioning whether or not this news was authentic, and it wasn't authentic, they went ahead and quietly did the executions. Horrific, horrific kind of diversion. And of course, that Twitter account, people looked into it and realized that this was most probably a regime account that was pretending to be opposition to gain legitimacy and a foothold, and did this clear disinformation campaign that was trying to divert a movement.
It's extremely challenging because you see on the one hand that the regime is using technology to limit the freedom and liberties of women and human rights defenders, but also those that are working on this topic. So in both of your opinion, what is the role of these tech giants such as Meta or X or other platforms? What roles do they have in actually protecting human rights and making sure that disinformation doesn't spread? Harold?
Well, when it comes to preventing online harassment, preventing online hate and stopping disinformation campaigns, they do very, very little. We see a problem which is becoming worse and worse, that the data giants use very little resources on protecting their users online, especially for services which are in other than the main languages, English and French. We see that this is more and more outsourced to automated systems. Which also leads to the other side, which you pointed out, that when you are falsely shut down, it is almost impossible to do anything about it as a human rights defender. Because I've talked to people who have been shut down because Also, you can organize campaigns to get Facebook, for example, to shut down the site of a human rights defender. And then this guy said, I don't think I've ever talked conversed with an actual human being. It's always automated systems that always give me the same answers. And you know, you have this argument, the internet is supposed to be free, the internet is supposed to be a forum for free exchange of opinions and information. But in fact, if we do not make sure that it is not used for harassment, that the data giants who earn billions by using the internet to put us all under surveillance, if they do not protect their users, then in the end, the internet will be one of the fora for harassment, for smear campaigns, for attacking people, and for squeezing out those who really work for freedom of expression and human rights.
But how can human rights organizations and other organizations such as Article 19 and Amnesty International better collaborate with these tech companies?
I mean, it's an ongoing struggle because I do fear that as more time passes, things are getting worse. I mean, take, for example, what we witnessed over the weekend with this fear that this war was about to break out between Iran and Israel. And there was mass amounts of misinformation really trying to escalate the situation. And this was promoted and further elevated by the fact that there's this new monetization model on Twitter or X, where, you know, the more engagement, the more outlandish things are, like there's more monetary incentives for people to put out just sensational posts. So this is really making the situation more problematic. And it is a bit difficult to understand how to engage with platforms such as Twitter, I guess, because whether we like it or not, they're still a very big player, especially in the Iranian context, I'm sure, in all the other countries you work on as well. They're a major player in having human rights discussions and having human rights accountability standards is very difficult. I mean, Article 19, of course, it's a free expression organization. We've worked for years to create these standards online. There's the Rabat Plan of Action, which puts out the thresholds needed for when you need to limit speech in order to prevent harm, real world harm. And, you know, platforms like X, and we also have Telegram. It is really becoming even more and more harmful. My colleague, Afsana Rigo, has this really great term for how technology should be designed. It's called design from the margins. When tech companies design for their most vulnerable users, they're making their technology basically the best platform for every user. And we really need to be implementing this more. Tech companies, technologists need to be really implementing this concept of design from the margins more and more into their thinking. There are a lot of companies that are engaging, that are having conversations with civil society. Obviously, we know the, you know, profit model of most of these companies, but it is an ongoing debate. There is a role, I guess, to be played by different institutions like the United Nations. The fact-finding mission, for example, had a lot of different recommendations to tech companies on how they could have helped prevent some of these abuses, what kind of responsibilities they hold when it comes to, you know, having these horrific real world events as we've seen in Iran and other parts of the world.
Gerald, you were mentioning earlier about where Iran is getting some of its technology from. I'm very curious to know, what exactly does the regime have in terms of access to technology? Do they have access to generative AI? Do they have access to advanced technologies like we do here in the West?
Well, there are mainly, probably you could say there are mainly two sources. One is friendly governments. Some friendly governments for the Iranian regime are China and Russia. China is a global technology leader when it comes to surveillance. Russia is not, but they also have systems that are quite advanced. And we know that many of Chinese and Russian systems are in place in Iran. But for example, when it comes to facial recognition systems, artificial intelligence based systems, things like that, surveillance systems. But the other source is also the free market, and so we have many of the most notorious private companies that produce surveillance software and sell it to anybody, including the most oppressive regimes, are companies based in the West. Even the European Union, which one should think there are rules now, but the rules really don't work. I mean, most famously, the Israeli NSO group has for many years been supplying even their worst enemies with surveillance software, highly advanced surveillance software that they can use to track down, hack, and persecute their own enemies, human rights defenders, which is the same software the Israeli government is using to track down, harass, and persecute Palestinians in the West Bank. So there is this international market going on. And that's an important point, because there still is a lot of possibility to do something about this with better trade regulations, with better control on the export of surveillance software, And with stricter measures actually to stop these kinds of exports.
I mean, we're talking about Iran today, but Iran is not the only government that is using technology to limit rights and freedoms of their civilians. You both also work in other countries and with other cases. Can you mention some other countries that are doing similar things, perhaps maybe even in the West?
Yeah, when we talk about the Iranian regime's capability of distracting, misdirecting mobile phones, so that the mobile phone thinks there is a base station close, which is actually a portable fake base station by the Secret Service. This is a tools that the American police has used for decades, and which became famous when they used it. And so these are things that are available, freely available all over the world, and that have been used to a much greater extent by countries like the United States, China, Russia, but also the United Kingdom, for example, for many years. And the scary part is that we see, I mean, it's almost, you could almost compare the arguments the Iranian government is using, why surveillance is necessary, to the arguments that governments like the British government is using. They also say we have to identify the enemies of the state. We have to identify people who have wrong or dangerous opinions. We have to pinpoint them before they can do anything wrong. And if we wreck the right to privacy, if we wreck freedom of expression and assembly, then so be it. And we see that very similar tools to the ones the Iranian government is using to oppress demonstrations there have been used, for example, in several Western countries to oppress pro-Palestinian demonstrations in the course of the Gaza War.
Mm, right. Do you have other examples from other countries?
I mean, I try to follow China as closely as possible because that's, I think, the ultimate mentor for the situation in Iran. And so, I mean, the kind of censorship technology they're developing to attack VPNs in Iran right now is really following the Chinese model of building the firewall that's resistance to VPNs. And VPNs are basically how you access the internet in Iran, because most of the free independent internet at this point is being censored. So that's really the model we've been following. And of course, with this facial recognition policing women and hijab in Iran, this has been a really difficult topic to assess. And I know myself and other colleagues have tried to kind of investigate in terms of what are the vendors, what are the materials being sold to Iran. And it's quite hard to know exactly what they have. We've had companies like China's Tiandi known to have sold traffic surveillance equipment to Iran. But of course, this is really packaged as like a benign technology that every country has. But traffic surveillance software and hardware, when, you know, coded to recognize faces, can be quite harrowing and concerning, obviously. You've had different companies. I believe the cutting edge, for example, of facial recognition hardware and cameras comes out of Germany. And it has been detected that German companies like Bosch have sold this kind of technology to Iran. Clearly, sanctions haven't worked in this case because, again, these technologies get packaged as very benign. But in terms of really understanding the proliferation of this technology in Iran, there has been a lot of bluster because, you know, you mentioned this need for creating this chilling effect. And so these big announcements of this sophisticated and all-pervasive surveillance technology has sometimes been kind of packaged as something to create a chilling effect, when in fact we can't necessarily assess the exact sophistication of their tools. Of course, we have Amnesty has done some really great documentation of how license plates of women driving cars without hijab have been used, documented at that level. But again, it's very difficult. But that's not to say that if this regime didn't have access or didn't have access to the resources to efficiently deploy across all, Iran is quite big, has 90 million people, its ability to deploy that technology, it wouldn't obviously hesitate to use it. But again, it's been a bit difficult. And I think you alluded to the fact that you can get access to vendors and technologies through unregulated markets that aren't necessarily overseen by sanctions. And of course, it's difficult in the Iranian case, because obviously the Israeli state, which has some of the most sophisticated surveillance technologies, isn't selling it to the Iranian state. And so if it's being traded, it's going to be in an off-market kind of way.
I mean, the cyberspace is incredibly difficult to regulate. What do you think the role of AI will be in this field? To just make it even a hint more complicated.
I think it's definitely a space to watch. In terms of assessing AI's role, I guess, right now in digital repression in Iran, it's hard to say. I don't think, we've seen it in, I guess we've seen some examples in the Russian context in terms of the role of generative AI in disinformation and misinformation. We haven't necessarily seen it deployed, at least not deployed in a way that we've seen make an impact yet in the Iranian context, but I definitely think we're going to get there very soon. The government is working on its tech industry and trying to make sure it's up to pace the way that we've seen them invest in obviously areas like censorship, the kind of censorship deployment they're doing with VPNs, for example, is definitely making use of different AI technologies to be able to kind of follow all the different protocols of all of these different anti-censorship tools, and to be able to block them has been, there has been a lot of guesses that they are using sophisticated AI tools to be able to do this very high level censorship. It's a space I think that is going to pervade everything from disinformation to censorship and surveillance. But it's a space that we're watching, I guess, for now.